WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Israelis and Palestinians are living in fear as the cycle of violence continues and the prospect of peace seems to be receding. We're going to hear from a Palestinian and an Israeli who have each written reflective memoirs that shed light on the larger conflict. Later we'll hear from Yossi Klein Halevi, who writes about Israel for the Jerusalem Report and the New Republic. My first guest is Raja Shahadeh, a human rights lawyer in Ramallah on the West Bank. He's a founder of the human rights organization Al-Haq, an affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists. His new memoir is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. His family is from Jaffa, the old Arab city adjoining Tel Aviv. In 1948, during fighting between Arabs and Jews, the family fled the city and went to a summer home in Ramallah. 3 weeks later, the State of Israel was declared, and Jaffa was included in the new state. The Shahada family remained in Ramallah. Raja was born in Ramallah 3 years after his family moved there. It was occupied by Israeli forces after the 1967 war. In Shahada's memoir, he writes about growing up with what he describes as the incessant, angry roar of people expelled from their homes.
What made the expulsion more difficult was the speed in which it happened and the fact that they felt they were taken by surprise and they were cheated out of their homes. For years, we lived with this feeling that they should have stayed, maybe should have fought more, maybe should have responded differently. The effect on me was that I always felt that our reality was not Ramallah, it was Jaffa. And the people who held the keys to that reality, to that lost world, were my parents. So to a large extent, I was a hostage to a world which I also felt was too imperiled to be taken for granted. It was held together by their words, their descriptions, their memories, their reminiscences. And so I wasn't free to live in my own world. It was always that this world was not good enough. One example of what this led to is it took me a very long time before I came to appreciate the beauty of the surroundings in Ramallah. The Ramallah hills are extremely attractive hills, but I always followed my father in his gaze, which went beyond the hills and looked to the horizon to Jaffa. So it really was a very long time before I finally was able to look at my surroundings and decide for myself, where is my place? What are my feelings? And rather than feel a hostage to the reality of others.
Now, your father was a lawyer who became politically active. When the family moved to Ramallah, it was part of Jordan and remained that way till 1967. Your father got into trouble with the Jordanian government when he represented three of the men accused of assassinating the king of Jordan. He also ran for the Jordanian parliament. He lost. He was imprisoned twice by the Jordanian government. What taste did this leave in your mouth about politics, watching your father become, you know, an enemy, perceived as an enemy of the government?
I grew up in two worlds, the world of my mother, which was the world of the house, and the world of my father, which was the world of the outside. And I was a weak child, so I was constantly pampered and stayed home. And I was more comfortable in the world of the house, in the world of my mother. And my father's world seemed an antagonistic world, a violent world. And I grew up thinking the worst of politics. The book, of course, is a memoir of my relationship with my father. And he was a person who could not see something wrong and not do something about it. He was an activist who was a man of principle. So he didn't calculate whether defending these people in that assassination trial would be a good thing or a bad thing. He thought, I'm a lawyer. My duty is to defend criminals, and I'm going to do it. He was that kind of a person. The effect on me was not so much political, except to the extent that it made me think the worst of politics. It was more emotional. So, for example, when the army came knocking at our door to pick my father up and take him to prison, that was a very frightening experience. And to this day, when people knock at the door in a loud way, I get very rattled, even when I know it's a friendly caller.
Your father said that he was considered a traitor by a lot of Palestinians and other Arab leaders because he was challenging the accepted wisdom of Arab leaders. What are some of the things he was challenging? How did his politics depart?
Well, he thought along with everybody else until 1967. He didn't really challenge the basic positions. And in 1967, he had a great change. Just after the war, he felt very depressed and, in fact, considered committing suicide. And my mother stopped him at the last minute. And then, immediately after the war, he had a change of mind about the whole situation. He realized that the Arab states keep promising that they will wage war and that they will do great things. And every time time comes for the war, we don't see any Arab soldiers and we have to fend for ourselves. And I describe in the book the events of the 1967 war and how miserable it was and how unprotected we felt. So in 1967, he thought enough is enough and Israel is a reality. He believed that it was in the interest of the Arab countries to keep Israel as an abstraction, a monolithic enemy which has which is used to quell people into submission and to keep them thinking about outside rather than about what needs to be done within their own country.
So in other words, if Arab leaders could keep Israel as an outside threat, it would keep the pressure off the Arab leaders to reform the country from within, because the dissidents would be arguing about Israel instead of arguing with their own leaders.
Yeah, this he felt very strongly. And he also felt that Israel, in fact, of course, has taken our land, has not compensated us and so on. But it is a reality which we have to come to terms with. And he made a proposal in 1967, which is very, very early on, where he proposed a two-state solution. And he believed that there has to be a partition of geographic Palestine between a Palestinian state and an Israeli state along the 67 borders, which included, of course, East Jerusalem as the capital.
Your father was denounced on a Palestinian broadcast from Damascus. And you quote the broadcast. The people said about your father, "You are a traitor, a despicable collaborator. You want to surrender and sell our birthrights. We know how to deal with the likes of you. You shall pay for your treason. We shall eliminate you, silence you forever. Traitor, collaborator." I'm wondering what it was like for you and for your father to hear him denounced as the enemy when, I mean, he was denounced by Palestinians as the enemy. And he was Palestinian. You're from a Palestinian family. So what was it like to be perceived by fellow Palestinians as the enemy?
It was a very difficult time for me. And it was difficult because I was not a political person. I didn't really formulate my own positions on any of these issues. I was taken along with my father from the early days of the occupation to go into the 48 areas of Israel and to see for myself Jaffa and to meet with his Israeli friends and get exposed in a way that none of my colleagues and friends were exposed. And he, of course, was constantly arguing that we have made mistakes, that we have to correct them, and we should not continue to allow others to determine our fate. And as far as my understanding went, I believed him and I thought he was saying absolutely the right things. And then all of a sudden I hear this strong denunciation. Also amongst my friends, there is a lot of popularity for the resistance movement outside. And as you can imagine, somebody, I was 16 at that time, the attraction of guerrilla warfare and fighting the enemy rather than accepting things or being so rational about it was maybe more typical for somebody of that age. So I was literally torn. But again, I didn't take political sides because I wasn't a political person. It was entirely emotional.
You went to college because you loved literature and wanted to study literature, but you ended up studying law as well, and you became a lawyer. When you, after your studies, returned to Ramallah in 1976, you were the first Western-educated lawyer to come back to the West Bank since 1948. Why did you go back?
This is a very important question, really, because all my life, and I suppose the culmination of this is this book. All my life, I've been trying to come to terms with my father, and he was the ideal which I could not feel fulfilled or feel that I'm living in reality if I avoided. I thought it would have been very easy for me to make an academic career. I was very successful in my academic studies, but it would have felt a betrayal. It would have felt that it is not a real life. And my sense of what was real was my father's life, just as my sense of what was real was Jaffa more than Ramallah. I had to come back in a profession which my father would respect and work with him and come to terms with him. So I wanted to be with him. I wanted to come back, but I was sure I wasn't going to come back on his terms. I was going to be my own lawyer, my own style of lawyer. I was going to do human rights because I believe in the principle. I'm going to write, and I continue to write all along. And of course, all of this created great conflicts between us because he said, oh, you're too distracted between your human rights work and your writing. You don't have enough time for the office. You're not being a good lawyer. And we had huge fights, which I think were unfair on his part, but they were part of the tension between us.
Now, in 1987, you say you embraced the Intifada and that you were really changed by the Intifada. Why did you embrace it? Because you had been, in your mind, not political, certainly for human rights, but not politically active, and you were always alienated by politics, more living more in your own mind, living more in literature than in that kind of political activism.
You know, somebody of my personality and character can never be a man of the people, can never really be a public person. I'm too individualistic to be anything of that sort. So when the Intifada started, it was my first experience of feeling that my struggle, my personal struggle, and the public struggle were at one. And it felt very good. Because for the first time, I was working with everybody. Because, you know, the first Intifada was different from the present Intifada in the sense that the whole community was threatened by an occupying army who were right amongst us, not in the peripheries, as is the case now. And so there was a lot of solidarity work. There was a lot of coming together to work on collective things against the occupation. And for a change, I felt myself, I was not withdrawing. I was not holding back. I was going along and feeling at one and feeling that this time we are going to win. And then, of course, some people would say, but how can we win against Israel? And I would say, if we believe in it, we will win. This is our war of liberation. So it was an entirely new experience, maybe more of a political experience than I've ever felt or ever will feel.
Now, you described that first Intifada, the one that started in 87, as the general rebellion of sons against their fathers. What do you mean by that?
You know, it was a very optimistic, romantic maybe time when we felt that we were going to change the way things were. We're going to change the educational system, create new legal system, create new relationships. Of course, this meant great difficulties for the fathers because the sons, the children, were feeling so empowered by this wave that teachers at schools were finding it very difficult to control students. Fathers at home were finding it very difficult to control their sons. But for me, as always, being the kind of person I am, there was also the sense that I was finally proving my father wrong because I was participating in a common action which was going to get us somewhere, and that was the way to do it. And his cynicism about the possibility of something like this ever happening was going to be proven wrong because it was happening.
And that's another sense that you saw it as a rebellion of sons against fathers.
Exactly.
It was
a general rebellion and also a personal rebellion.
My guest is Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh. His new memoir is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Raja Shahadeh, and he's just written a memoir called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. He's a human rights lawyer in Ramallah. His father was a very political lawyer. In 1991, you joined the Palestinians at the Middle East Peace Conference as the Palestinian legal advisor. So here you are, going from human rights lawyer to really entering the political process. That was over 10 years ago, and things have just totally fallen apart. I'm wondering how your work in the early 90s with the peace process left you feeling then, and then we'll get to how you're feeling now.
Well, it didn't take very long for me, because I stayed for 1 year with the negotiating team, and after the year I decided that I'm not going to have any ability to influence anything. I felt there was something happening somewhere else. I didn't know what that was. I wasn't sure of anything. But I was sure that I'm not going to be effective in Washington. And I took myself and went back to Ramallah. It was exactly a year after I had started. And I stayed away. And then in 1993, sure enough, I discovered that there were secret negotiations taking place while the negotiating delegation was in Washington. And then I discovered that they had made an agreement between the PLO and Israel. And my doubts were proven correct. There was something cooking.
Why did you feel like you had no influence?
Because I understood exactly the Israeli position. I had been following since 1978 the Israeli changes in the occupied territories, which I saw will culminate in an agreement if Israel would have its way, and culminate in an agreement that would be bad for us, because it would confirm all the ills of occupation without breaking through into something that would lead us to peace. And the main problem, of course, was the Israeli settlements. But, you know, the Israeli settlements is a political issue, but it had translated into a very definite legal arrangement, which gave two systems, legal and administrative, to the Israeli settlers in the West Bank and the Palestinians, who lived side by side, subject to two different systems. I saw that being established year after year, slowly being built up. I saw it, I wrote about it, I tried to warn people that this is going to lead to disaster. And when the negotiations began, I saw that it was my role to point out that if we allow Israel to confirm the system, then we will have no peace in the area. And when I realized that what I was talking about was not accepted, was not being understood, much as I tried, however I tried, I thought I cannot do any more. I left.
So the first intifada was a real turning point for you. It politicized you. You felt for the first time a part of a larger movement. What about the current intifada? Do you feel connected to that at all?
No, the current intifada is very different, because it's a militarized intifada. In the first intifada, we all felt we had something to say. We were able to carry on with our narrative, so to speak, that even if one was not political, you responded to what the political statements said, and you felt they were speaking for you. Whereas now the violence has silenced everybody. And interestingly enough, this is true on both sides, the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. The violence has not just silenced everybody.
What do you mean it has silenced everybody?
Well, every time there is a violent action, one doesn't feel able to say anything. You're so overwhelmed by the shock and the brutality and the sadness that there's nothing to say.
It seems that many, perhaps even most Israelis, have lost their faith in Arafat as a partner for peace. And I'm wondering if you think that Palestinians have lost faith in Arafat.
Well, the Palestinians have been disappointed in many ways by the Palestinian Authority, which came into being as a result of the Oslo. The work of human rights organizations, mine and others, and the work of people who worked on democracy issues, bore some fruit, because people really were expecting that once we get the chance, we will have a system which would have accountability, which would have more equality, more of the Western type relations that democratic relations that we had come to aspire for, and interpret our struggle as leading us to. They were disappointed on many such counts. The problem, though, is that the Palestinian Authority and Arafat as an elected leader of that authority came as a result of a political process and an agreement which was signed between Israel and the PLO. What Israel is trying to do in ousting Arafat is forgetting about or unilaterally destroying the agreement. I, as a lawyer and as a Palestinian living there, have great trepidation from the legal vacuum that will be created as a result. If there is to be change, it has to be done properly and carefully rather than unilaterally by Israel. Otherwise, I have great fear that we would be in a legal vacuum. And a legal vacuum for the weaker side would be a disaster, because then Israel would have a free hand to do what it would like.
Raja Shahadeh is the author of the memoir Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. We'll hear more from him in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Raja Shahadeh. He's a human rights lawyer in Ramallah on the West Bank. His new memoir is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. As a human rights activist and lawyer, what are your reactions when there are Palestinian attacks on civilians in Israel at shopping centers? A recent attack at a girl's bar mitzvah, a religious ceremony. What do you think about when that happens?
It's extremely shocking thing to happen. Extremely shocking thing to happen. When you and I don't know in this country if you're shown the details, but Israeli television are very explicit in what they show. It just makes one's life miserable. But at the same time, it makes my life miserable to realize that there are people on my side, people who I see in the street, who have come to the point of such despair about the future that they are willing to shatter their body into a million pieces because they have no hope, no future. At the same time, I was always alarmed by how the Israeli missiles had hit Palestinian children and Palestinians in a car, and their bodies also shattered. And there were children who were shown on television, on one of the satellite televisions, also picking the flesh of these shattered bodies. And the next day, there was an attack in Israel. So it's as though it's a cycle. One tragedy leads to another. It's whoever does it, it is unacceptable, morally unacceptable, and politically bringing us to disaster.
You write in your memoir that you had heard all these things about Israel and heard all these things about Jewish people, but you'd never really met anybody Jewish until, I guess it was 1967, when the Israeli troops came in during the occupation. And that was your first and for a while your only exposure with people who were Jewish. I'm wondering if you've met a lot of Jewish people from Israel or other parts of the world, and what it's been like for you to meet with or perhaps even to work with people who had been really demonized from everything that you'd heard and you'd never had any encounters of your own before.
You know, the assumption from the outside, from what all that you see, is that the two societies are very separated. It may be true now because of the present intifada and of the imposition of all these closures on the Palestinian towns and villages. But the country was never divided from 1967 until the early 90s. Anybody could take their car and drive anywhere in Palestine, Israel. All kinds of people had relations. Businessmen had relations. Workers had relations. Farmers had relations. Merchants had relations. So many people, and of course there were these very unfortunate relations of people who were taken into prison and learned Hebrew in prison and got to know their jailers, one kind of experience, of course. But the number of people who, for example, speak Hebrew, who've seen and learned and had an opportunity to intermingle with the Israeli society is tremendous. And of course, there are more similarities than there are differences. So there were great possibilities for one to learn about the other. And had the Israelis had the wisdom, the prudence, they could have used the Palestinians and what they've learned about the Israelis as a bridge to the rest of the Arab world. Unfortunately, they were more interested in acquiring this land and keeping it than in making bridges of peace. And people speak about coexistence now between Palestinians and Israelis. Well, you can't have coexistence when every day you look out of your window and you see a settlement right next to your house, which has been built on land that has been taken from you or from your family or from your friends. And the spring of water is used by the settlers. And you have to bring in your water in a tanker. I mean, you can't possibly have coexistence on such inequality.
Raja Shahadeh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Raja Shahadeh is the author of Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. He's a human rights lawyer in Ramallah. This is Fresh Air.